I made all my sacraments here. I went to school here all 8th grades. This is home to me. And so he destroyed my home. And we're going to try and bring it back.
Strength in the face of unspeakable tragedy. A state, city, archdiocese, and parish look to the future as Catholic faithful seek God's grace to ease their grief after the first mass shooting at a Catholic school in America. Pilgrims from around the world arrive in Rome for the canonization of two new saints, young men whose example has inspired millions. We report from St. Peter's Square.
The paradox of God being made present in the midst of darkness and suffering.
We talk to the director of a powerful new film about another modern-day Catholic saint who brought God's light into the evil of a Nazi concentration camp. And we have an introduction to make as we welcome an important new member of the EWTN News On Air team. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
One law, one executive order, one policy. You can call it the Annunciation Bill. Then I'll be able to look Lydia and Sophia and all my students in the eye and say I tried.
A teacher and father calls for action after a shooting at his Catholic school's church left his daughter wounded. As the Minneapolis community grapples with the loss of two young students, it seeks solutions from government leaders, hoping that such a tragedy can be prevented in the future. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. As conversations this week turn to potential solutions, from gun reform to mental health resources to school security, the Annunciation Catholic Church community continues to grieve the shocking tragedy of a mass shooting on its grounds last week, the first at a Catholic school in U.S. history. As they try to move forward, many parishioners are turning to prayer for healing and solace.
We welcome the light of a new day here at Annunciation.
In the wake of horrific tragedy, parishioners of Annunciation Catholic Church in Minneapolis gathered for Mass in the parish auditorium last Saturday, their first after a gunman opened fire on their community on August 27th. Father Dennis Zarin, the church's pastor, reflected on that moment in his homily.
Jesus says, "Can you just sit with me here in the dust for a while? Sit with me here in this low place." And that was the very first message we heard on Wednesday morning when that first bullet came through the window.
On that sorrowful day, Zarin was at the altar offering Mass for the beginning of the school year with hundreds of students and parishioners when bullets began to fly through the church's stained glass windows. 23-year-old Robert Westman, who went by the name Robin, barricaded two doors of the church and fired from a rifle, shotgun, and pistol, all purchased lawfully. Witnesses recounted the horror of the moment.
Immediately when we heard noises, a split second later we saw flashes, and then followed by panic screaming, kids covering their ears.
I just saw glass shattering going down the line, and we were hiding underneath the pews.
We were crying, and we both reached our hands towards each other. We couldn't touch. We both prayed the Hail Mary.
10-year-old Harper Moiske and 8-year-old Fletcher Merkel lost their lives in the shooting. 21 others were wounded by the gunfire, including 18 children and 3 elderly adults. 12-year-old Sophia Fortress is still fighting for her life after being struck in the head. Witnesses recount the heroism of those who try to stand in the way of the bullets.
I mean, the real heroes here are the children that are protecting each other and the adults in there that stayed in that main area the whole time.
Westman fatally shot himself shortly after opening fire. Minneapolis police say they have not found a clear motive, but confirmed Westman had a connection to the parish and that he idolized mass shooters in his writings.
There is no question in this case that this shooter intended to terrorize the children, the school members of the school community, the parishioners were inside of that church.
The shooting has shaken faith communities across the country and the globe, even garnering a message of prayer and petition from the first U.S.-born Pope, Pope Leo XIV, at his Sunday Angelus.
Our prayers for the victims of the tragic shooting during a school mass in the American state of Minnesota. Let us plead God to stop the pandemic of arms, large and small, which infects our world.
This week, Vice President J.D. Vance, a Catholic convert, visited Minneapolis to speak with the victims' families.
These parents opened up their lives, opened up their hearts. They told me about their kids. They told me about their families. They told me about the community supporting them. And that was just an amazing thing to see.
Democratic Governor Tim Walz plans to call a special legislative session to propose tougher gun laws. Some faith leaders are hoping lawmakers will also deliver much-needed security funding for non-public schools like Annunciation. Our sister news service, the National Catholic Register, reported the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the state's dioceses, asked both in 2022 and 2023, private schools receive the same government funding as public schools for security. Those appeals went unanswered. The Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas worked closely with the Catholic Conference on the issue.
When it comes to public safety, these are all our kids. These are all our babies. Like, no one should go to a school in Minnesota, public or non-public, and not be safe. But when we are able to partner with the government, it means there's just a little bit more funding available for other things, or we can do it better and faster.
Ethan Roberts, the council's deputy executive director, notes the Jewish community is interconnected with the Catholic community and is ready to offer support and deep experience with security matters.
To be Jewish is to be part of like a people, a extended family. And we consider our Catholic brothers and sisters, I'm required to share what we have, right? The political, whatever capital we may have, the expertise we may have in security, whatever it is that the Catholic community needs, you just have to ask.
Minneapolis Catholics appreciate the support of the Minneapolis community. Twin Cities Archbishop Bernard Hebda has seen those impacted by the tragedy turn to prayer.
I get the idea that people are very much turning to the Lord at this time and just been a real outpouring of love.
He will soon reconsecrate Annunciation's main church, reclaiming it from the tragedy and allowing it to once again be used for Mass.
Well, for us as Catholics, the Eucharist is so important, both for building community, but then also as a sacrament of healing. And we certainly need both of those things here in Minneapolis.
Joining us now from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Jason Atkins, Executive Director and General Counsel for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. He has led the conference since 2011. Jason, thanks for being with us. I first want to offer my condolences to the Catholic community in St. Paul, Minneapolis, in the wake of this tragedy. It's been just over a week. How is the community doing?
Catherine, thanks for the invitation. It's humbling to be here in the wake of these tragic events. There is a lot of pain here. There's no question about that. Almost everyone, it seems, in our Catholic community has a connection to Annunciation, someone who is affected by this tragedy directly. A good friend of mine was the 911 caller. He was on the altar during that shooting. One of our bishops went to grade school there. My sister was married there. One of our advisory committee members, his niece is still in the hospital recovering. So this is something that has impacted all of us here in the Twin Cities mm-hmm. Catholic community, and the effects of that and the pain of that will continue to be felt. But I want to just underscore that the light shines in the darkness mm-hmm. and the darkness shall not overcome it. So as we see this pain, we see out of that suffering tremendous acts of heroism, goodness, kindness, solidarity, as you've already chronicled mm-hmm. in this report. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beautiful thing, that you're seeing this community come together and rally around these people and these families, and a strong belief that there will be hope, and there's still hope, and there is healing, and we will rise stronger mm-hmm. from this. So it's really beautiful to witness that and to watch that.
Amen to that. Jason, this tragedy has really put the spotlight on security, specifically for non-public schools. And your conference, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, made requests to state officials both in 2022 and in 2023 to extend funds for security upgrades and for emergency response training in non-public schools. Tell us about that, Jason. What were you asking for exactly, and what was the response?
Tragically, this, what happened in Annunciation, is not the first faith community affected. It's not the first school affected. And so we've been consistent advocates for policies that include and are non-discriminatory against non-public school students. Just as it's the case that the police and the fire department need not drive by a church or a non-public mm-hmm. school when they're providing services, we think that when the state makes a commitment to protecting students and to promote public safety, this is a basic public safety issue that should be available to all students, irrespective of where they go to school. Mm-hmm. It's just an important public safety measure. And we think that non-public school students should be treated equitably. We've called upon leaders to do so. They have not in the past, mm-hmm. unfortunately. You know, people have noticed that. And I think in the wake of this tragedy, as we looked at holistic solutions to preventing gun violence, looking at school safety programs, nonprofit security grants, all these things, we have to take an all of the above approach to looking at public policy solutions mm-hmm. that limit gun violence in our communities.
And what about the potential of accessing federal sources for this?
The nonprofit security grants at the federal level constitute what's called receipt of federal funds. Mm-hmm. And under my understanding, that those come with strings attached. Mm-hmm. So if you take the federal government's money, you're a recipient of federal funds, then there are ways in which those can bind your hands on particular things like employment matters, but also policies and programming as well. So Catholic institutions have been reticent about taking mm-hmm. federal grants. Unfortunately, it's been the case in some places and in some states where state supplemental grant programs have developed workarounds or have not applied some of those same funding criteria. And so in here in Minnesota, we're looking at ways in which we need to possibly reform our program, or I think there's a conversation that should be had at the federal level about how to make those funds more available to non-public school communities and faith communities as well. Mm.
Governor Tim Walz is calling for a special session on gun legislation. What are your goals for that session? I understand your conference just released a statement on this.
There are practical impediments to a special session. I think Governor Walz and his concern about this issue was very forthright in saying we need to do something, but there are a lot of practical impediments here in Minnesota to making a special session even gavel in, let alone coming to concrete solutions. Our goal is, as always, is to be a bridge builder, to provide and build common ground for the common good. And so recognizing that we can't be satisfied in thinking that partisan solutions, one-sided solutions, limited solutions are going to be moving the needle. If we want a state with a divided legislature to get something done, people will have to make compromises. People have to be flexible. They'll have to recognize the limits politically of what people in the other house and in the other party can do and can accomplish. And so in that context, we don't want to be proposing one-sided solutions. We want to be taking that all-of-the-above approach and looking at the multifaceted nature of the problem of gun violence and the reality that it will take multiple solutions as well, whether that's inclusive of gun regulations, school safety measures, mm-hmm. mental health considerations, addressing some other deeper cultural questions. Mm-hmm. It's an all-of-the-above approach, and we have to have honest conversations and take a look at every facet of this problem and explore creative solutions. Again, our role is to build common ground for the common good.
Jason, you mentioned how there can be strings attached when it comes to federal funding. That being said, do you foresee that Catholic schools and churches will need to prioritize private funding in order to increase security? And then will that just lead to greater disparity in security for those Catholic schools in lower income areas?
Well, people often think that Catholic schools or private schools are these posh places that have all these resources, but in many instances, their ministries run on blood, sweat, and tears and a shoestring budget. And so we no doubt have a responsibility to provide a safe environment on a number of levels for our students and in our communities, and devote precious resources to do that. But we also think that we can be partners with the government in that approach. And again, government can, in fact, should prioritize the needs of all students, mm-hmm. not base that funding and that support dependent on where they go to school. It's a public safety issue. It's not an education finance issue. And so it has to be treated that way. And so what, regardless of where you go to school, you should receive that same funding. And as legislators consider funding streams for school safety and public school safety, let's not leave faith communities or non-public schools out of that mm-hmm. equation.
Jason, in my last minute with you, any final thoughts as we reflect on what is now the first mass shooting at a Catholic school? What is the significance of this moment for Catholic Americans?
I think it requires us, as we've been affected directly, of course, we've worked assiduously to provide solidarity and support to other communities, and the Jewish community in particular, of course, during times of tragedy. But it's really, again, I think, thinking about the multifaceted nature of this problem and the fact that there are a lot of different solutions as well. And we have to look at all those. We have to see with the eyes of Christ and see the breadth and complexity, not start with our own presuppositions or pet concerns, but look at all the facts and address that holistically. But ultimately, there's no political solution to what's ultimately a theological mm. and spiritual problem. The answer to all these problems and challenges is ultimately the call to holiness. Mm. The purpose of Catholic social teaching is the call to holiness. Mm-hmm. And we have to be honest with ourselves that the shooter in this instance went to a Catholic school, came from a Catholic mm-hmm. family, but somewhere things went off the tracks. And so we need to, as much as we want to opine or work politically, we need to get our own houses in order and foster holiness in our lives and do that through prayer and fasting and be attentive to the things that are in our purview in our mm-hmm. corner of the vineyard, mm-hmm. particularly our parishes, our families, and our local communities. We have a red flag law in this state, but the red flags were not caught in this mm. instance. And that's, I think, tragic because it shows that we don't have quite the webs of solidarity that need to be in place where we know and see people who are struggling and hurting, and hurt people mm. hurt people. Mm. We need to lean into yeah. that dynamic, and that starts with yeah. fostering holiness in our own lives.
Jason, our prayers are with you in Minnesota. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Catherine. God bless.
At the end of this week, Archbishop Hebda led a virtual rosary for an end to violence against children and for the healing of all affected by the shooting. He and other community members are praying in a special way for Sophia Fortress. At the time of our recording, she remains in critical condition. We join in praying for young Sophia and all victims of this tragedy. Ahead, the blessed lives and deaths at a young age have ultimately led to the canonization this weekend of our newest saints. A preview of the celebration next.
I'm Colin Flynn in front of St. Peter's Square here in Rome, where this weekend Pope Leo XIV's first canonizations of Pier Giorgio Frassati and Carlo Acutis. I'll have more from Rome on that next.
Welcome back to EWTN News in Depth as we take a look at a very busy week of activity at the Vatican and other papal properties. On Friday, Pope Leo inaugurated the Borgo Ladelto Si Center at Castel Gandolfo. The 135-acre project allows visitors to tour the formerly private gardens and farms of the papal palace and will provide hands-on experiences and training like making cheese and farming sustainably. The Holy Father took his own turn about the grounds, even stopping at one of the Castel ponds to feed the fish. Inspired by the late Pope Francis's encyclical Laudato Si, the center aims to be a model in caring for the earth, our common home. Then on Sunday, a mass many Catholics have been anticipating for years now, where Pope Leo will canonize Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati and Blessed Carlo Acutis. Frassati was a Third Order Dominican from the early 20th century who loved mountain climbing and serving the poor. He died from polio in 1925 at the age of 24. 90s kid Blessed Carlo Acutis lived nearly a century later and is known for his knack for technology and devotion to the Eucharist. The first millennial saint, he died in 2006 at the age of 15. Pope Francis intended to canonize both the young Italians at separate events earlier this year, but his death postponed the masses. Leo then announced September 7th as the new date, where they will be canonized together. Joining us now from St. Peter's Square is correspondent Colm Flynn, who will be anchoring EWTN's live coverage of the canonization mass of Blessed Carlo Acutis and Pier Giorgio Frassati in Rome. Colm, what's the feeling in Rome right now leading up to the canonization mass? Are you already seeing those crowds pour in?
Catherine, hey, great to see you. And yes, I can tell you this evening as I stand here, there are people just gathering in St. Peter's Square in anticipation of what is to come this weekend. It is going to be a truly historic event in the church. And I think to sum up the feeling, it's a mix of a number of things. As I mentioned, the excitement is there. These are two young millennial saints that are going to come to the church. That is pretty exciting. And the first ones under Pope Leo XIV's pontificate. But also anticipation. You know, people are reaching out, coming from all over the world. Hey, where do you get a ticket? What are the crowds going to be like? What time do I have to get there? But I think, Catherine, the overarching feeling is one of gratitude. Remember, these canonizations were meant to happen earlier in the year, but we know what transpired. So people came to Rome already expecting these canonizations. That changed into a papal funeral. They came back for Tour Vergata, all these youth, and now many of them are coming back for a third time to the Eternal City. So there's a mix of emotions, but I think gratitude is the overarching one as we head into this very exciting weekend.
And as you mentioned, Blessed Carlo Acutis and Pier Giorgio are the first saints Pope Leo XIV is canonizing. Can you speak to the significance of that for his pontificate?
Yeah, and you know, two very different people in that they lived, what, a century apart. One born in 1901, one born in 1991. But so many similarities too in that a lot of the young people who are coming here can really relate to them. Pier Giorgio Frassati was into mountaineering and hiking and hanging out with his friends, singing from the treetops up in northern Italy where he was from. And then Carlo Acutis liked to play video games. He liked to code and design websites. And the significance with Pope Leo XIV is that when you look at some of the things that our new Holy Father has talked about already in this short pontificate, you know, the dangers of artificial intelligence, social media being a great place to evangelize and for what he calls digital missionaries, but also warning against the perils of algorithms that can divide us and separate us. When you look at our millennial saint, Carlo Acutis, he was in that space. He was into computers from a young age, but he also limited the time he spent online and playing computer games because he saw the beauty and the benefits of it, but he also saw the drawbacks and the dangers. So there are so many parallels between, for example, Carlo Acutis and Pope Leo XIV, the kind of things that he is emphasizing so far and talking about. Even at Tour Vergata, Catherine, when he spoke to over a million young people, he talked about social media from the altar to all the young people. And I was there in the crowd. You could hear a pin drop. He was speaking their language. There's a great sense that he knows the world they live in, the concerns they have. And so the fact that he has, yes, said, although these canonizations were meant to happen under the late Pope Francis, the fact that they are happening so soon now shows that he is saying, these are a priority for me and my pontificate.
Certainly saints for our time. And Colm, you recently joined a pilgrimage across Italy with young men to learn about Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati. What were some of the highlights of that pilgrimage? And what were you surprised to learn about this soon-to-be saint?
Catherine, the whole thing was a highlight because it was so much fun joining a group of 15 young men from the Carolinas, from Alabama, from Ohio, from New York, California, right across the United States, all coming from different places in their faith, some devout Catholics, some curious, having recently converted. So it was fascinating to join these great young men. We started in Turin, the birthplace of Pier Giorgio Frassati. We saw the house he grew up in. We saw the places that he would pray and go to Mass. And then we went and we actually, Catherine, hike the mountain that he hiked with his friends. Now, I think I'm in pretty okay shape. I try and go to the gym, cut back in the gelato and the pasta. But that was pretty tough hiking up that mountain. But the highlight, I think, was, Catherine, when we got to the mountaintop, the very same place. We were standing on the same ground where Pier Giorgio Frassati, soon to be saint, was standing. And we celebrated Mass. And when Father Vincent Bernard, who is the chaplain at NYU, when he started to celebrate Mass, you know, you can be a bit distracted looking at the beautiful scenery and the terrain across all of northern Italy, but mist descended on the mountain and all we could see and concentrate was on the Holy Mass in front of us. That was a really moving experience for me, for the EWTN crew, but for those 15 young men too. And if you haven't seen it, and I hope you have, you can check it out on the EWTN YouTube page as well.
A beautiful documentary and work that you did there, Colm. And Colm, Carlo Acutis' own family is expected to be at his canonization mass. What a rare and powerful experience for a family. Talk about that.
Yeah, because normally when we talk about a saint, you know, we think of people who have been resigned to the history books in a way. Of course, the saints are always with us and we pray to them and for their intercession. But, you know, they're of another time normally. But I've met young people before when talking about their devotion, for example, to Carlo Acutis, and then they can say something like, oh, yeah, and I met his mother. Now, can you imagine that, meeting the mother of a saint and being able to say, well, I've read all about Carlo Acutis. I've seen his website for Eucharistic miracles. But what was he like as a son? And, you know, people, when they see his mother, again, it makes it more relatable because they can maybe see bits of their own mother in his mother and see that he came from a very normal family. And again, in one way, he was very much like other young people, but in another way, he was quite extraordinary and quite unique in the challenges he had to face, dying of leukemia at only 15 years of age. How he faced that with such courage and with such faith, it can be such an example to us. So to be here and to know that we are with them in spirit, the saints, and they're with us here at the Mass this weekend, but to know then that his mother and his siblings are here in the crowd as well, and we're all celebrating this canonization together, that's a pretty unique and extraordinary thing.
Well, we are so grateful for your reporting and we'll be praying for your coverage this weekend. Colm Flynn, thank you so much.
Catherine, my pleasure, and thank you so much.
Colm will anchor EWTN's coverage of this historic event this weekend. On Saturday, tune into a one-hour canonization special at 1 p.m. Eastern. And Sunday morning will be live at 3 a.m. Eastern time as Pope Leo XIV celebrates the canonization mass of Blessed Carlo Acutis and Pier Giorgio Frassati at the Vatican. We'll air an encore at 6 p.m. Eastern. Be sure to see all programming details at our website, EWTN.com. When we return, we're excited. We have some important family information to share about EWTN News.
Well, I think it just shows our children that, you know, these are real people. You know, this isn't just voices we hear. These are real events, that we are not the only Catholics in the world.
EWTN had the pleasure of hosting many of you last weekend at our annual family celebration. You got to meet us in person, and very importantly, we got to meet you, too. A few highlights of our gathering when we return. Welcome back. It was a true pleasure seeing so many of you, EWTN's loyal viewers, listeners, and readers, this past weekend at the annual EWTN Family Celebration in Tysons Corner, Virginia. Our annual get-together goes to a different location around the U.S. or Canada, and the Washington, D.C. area was our stop this year. On-air hosts, EWTN authors, and other staff members shared faith and fellowship with more than 1,200 of you as we all gather to celebrate what our foundress, Mother Angelica, created more than 40 years ago.
I like the meet and greet. I like to, you know, see the people that we see on TV all the time. And that excites me. That's always fun to get to know them and stuff.
Yeah. And then having the relics here, this is the first time I've had seen the relics. The spiritual warriors just gives me the inspiration to keep fighting, to strive. Like Mother Angelica said, we're all called to be saints. You know, don't miss the opportunity.
To talk to the different hosts and so on and see that they're just regular people but are really inspired by Mother Angelica and kind of her vision, it's truly a neat experience.
Discussions this year included a session with the EWTN team that covered Pope Francis's funeral, conclave, and election of Pope Leo XIV. They talked about what it was like to report on this moment in history. Among other speakers, I was privileged to share a glimpse into how my 12 years with this network has not only blessed my work life, but my personal life and faith life as well. And an exciting announcement about our sister broadcast, EWTN News Nightly, the newscast that airs every night, Monday through Friday at 6 and 9 p.m. Eastern. We are pleased to introduce the newscast's new anchor, Veronica Dudo. She spoke with our Monse Alvarado earlier this week in our Washington, D.C. studios.
What's your hope as you walk into the EWTN family?
What drew me to EWTN was its unwavering mission to serve the faithful and also to be a voice of truth. It's such a crazy time. There's so much noise and distraction that's out there in the world. And it just seemed like an amazing opportunity to help people understand what's happening, to tell stories through a Catholic lens. I have always been a very curious person about others, the world around me. I knew very early on I enjoyed storytelling, and so being a journalist was a great way to be able to do that. Having the opportunity in line with EWTN's mission to inform, to educate, to evangelize, the big emphasis is on the next world. Yes. What's next? And
hopefully heaven.
Exactly. Just to be able to be a part of a team that wants to tell the news, to make sure our viewers are informed, that it's in line with the teachings of the church, with truths and morals associated with it. It's something that I think is really needed.
What's the most important thing that you think the EWTN News Nightly team, daily, nightly news, 30 minutes, that news digest, can do to serve our audience and those who are hungry for truth?
So the team is made up of amazing journalists who are working very hard, and they are extremely dedicated. But it is the opportunity to help people to learn what's happening in the world, but to make those stories come alive through the church teaching, and to also help people in their own spiritual lives. So I think it's such an amazing opportunity where people are able to learn what's happening, but it's not just the headlines. It does go beyond that.
Do you feel like in your role communicating the news, you now will have another opportunity to also communicate Christ through the news?
Absolutely. I was very excited to be a journalist, to give a voice to those who would otherwise go unheard. And so in that opportunity, just to try to spread the word about what's happening in the world, but also through that Catholic lens, it's really something that I look forward to being a part of in this family that's worldwide. I know when I was able to cover the 2016 Year of Mercy at the Vatican, that was amazing under Pope Francis, to walk through the holy doors, to interview people who were making their own pilgrimages there. That was incredible. And so any opportunity to be out and to talk to people about what they have gone through, it's always been something that I have enjoyed very much throughout my career.
When you think about your role as a woman in the church, obviously Mother Angelica, an entrepreneur, someone who really changed the course of history and media in the United States and around the world, is there a desire that you have in your heart about how you might be able to share a witness of faith for other women who might not see themselves in the same way?
When we look at Mother Angelica, it was incredible, her idea and what she was able to build when you look at the time in the 80s to now. And it's just really grown like a tree with so many branches, and it really has helped people. Just even looking at the most recent conclave that you were a part of, I was watching. I know so many other people were, to see what was happening with the church. And so because of that one idea that she had and the tenacity that she had to keep going, it's just a gift that keeps giving, is trying to help people understand their faith or maybe learn about this faith for the first time. And it's really incredible.
Well, Veronica, I know that you can be assured of the prayers of everyone at EWTN as you enter into this family and join us in this great mission Mother Angelica prayed for and then acted on bringing news to the world, bringing EWTN and Jesus Christ through the airwaves, through the digital space, online, wherever you are. EWTN is too, we like to say, and now you get to be a part of that. So thank you for joining us.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
A warm welcome to Veronica. Be sure to join Veronica starting this Monday, September 8th, as she begins to present the day's news from a Catholic perspective on EWTN News Nightly at 6 and 9 p.m. Eastern. And please join our prayers for Veronica as she takes on this critical role in our news team. News headlines are next in the Week in Review, a big show of military pageantry in China, with the leaders of Russia and North Korea looking on. We are joined by a leading analyst on U.S.-China policy. Congress is back from summer recess and dealing with multiple controversies, one named Epstein, the other RFK Jr. And Florida says it will no longer mandate childhood vaccines. What are the ramifications? We'll be right back. A massive show of Chinese military might this week during a parade in Beijing tops the Week in Review. The event commemorated the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II and illustrated Chinese President Xi Jinping's determination to build a world-class army to rival the United States. Troops marched in lockstep by the viewing stand as President Xi showed off both the manpower and military hardware he said illustrates the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. The grand parade was for both domestic consumption as well as international. Foreign leaders from about two dozen countries seeking strong relationships with China attended, including guests of honor Vladimir Putin of Russia and, making a rare foreign trip, Kim Jong-un of North Korea. During the spectacle, much of the weaponry and equipment was being put on public display for the first time, including land, sea, and air-based strategic weapons, the so-called nuclear triad. Military experts say at least 11 new weapon systems were revealed, including advanced precision equipment and drones. An American national security analyst says the Chinese don't do military parades very often, but when they do, they, quote, don't mess around.
Having this group of other leaders, Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un, the president of Iran, all there, reinforce China's role as the centerpiece of a new coalition that is basically there to challenge the West. And his message was, this is what we challenge it with.
Among the nuclear triad weapons unveiled at the V-Day military parade was China's new liquid-fueled intercontinental strategic missile. The land-based nuclear missile has a global strike range. Experts say China's nuclear arsenal has grown faster than that of any other country, expanding by approximately 100 warheads per year since 2023. Joining us now to discuss what we saw this week in China is attorney, author, and foreign policy expert Gordon Chang. He is a senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. Thank you for joining us. Gordon, what should the United States and the West make of this show of Chinese military might in the V-Day parade in Beijing? With China's unveiling of so many new advanced weapon systems, can America still rightfully claim global military supremacy?
Well, we don't know whether these weapons are operational or whether they've been deployed or whether they even exist. So there's a lot there to ponder. But the one thing, Kat, that we have seen is over the last 3 or 4 weeks, there's been this almost unprecedented campaign on the part of China to show its weapons to us. And that reminds me of the ancient Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu, who said, "When weak, appear strong." So I think that they are trying too hard. Hmm. Now, that's not to say China doesn't have a capable military, or at least it doesn't. We can't say that they don't have great weapons, because we know that they do. But the point is, I think they're protesting too much.
Hmm. President Xi said the theme of the parade was to affirm China's commitment to peace and the armed forces' determination to safeguard it. Should potential international foes like Taiwan and the U.S. consider this a show of peace, or is this a potential threat of war?
Xi Jinping talks about going to war all the time, at least when he thinks we're not listening. So we can take the discussion of peace sort of off the table. We know that they are not only talking about it, but they're also engaged in the fastest military buildup since the Second World War. They're stockpiling grain and other commodities. They are mobilizing their civilians for war. They are trying to sanction-proof the regime. So this really is, I think, a society that is mobilizing not only the military, but also civilians to go into battle. Mm-hmm. And that means we've got to be concerned.
Absolutely. And Gordon, look at the lineup of guests China invited to witness this parade. The country's many Washington leaders have called the axis of evil. China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. It was quite a sight to watch President Xi, Vladimir Putin, and Kim Jong-un all together. Are we seeing the making of a new world order and the decline of the Western alliance?
Well, we certainly are seeing a split in the post-Cold War world. And there is whatever, you know, people call it the crinks, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. Some people say axis of upheaval. Whatever we want to call it, they are forming more durable relationships. But this has been going on for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And we've got to remember that the main players, the four of them, are actually weak states. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have to make sure that we understand that our democracies are strong mm-hmm. and we should not be intimidated, because the Chinese are trying to use intimidation to get us to back down and not to defend our friends and allies.
Hmm. Xi, Putin, and Kim are seen among the world's most powerful autocrats. Xi and Kim are both supporting Russia in its war of aggression against Ukraine. China is helping to finance the war by buying Russian oil. North Korea is sending troops to help man the front lines. Gordon, can the U.S. do anything to break up this trio of dictators and to help Ukraine reach an acceptable agreement to end the war?
We can tighten the sanctions, and more important, we can enforce them. We can cut off most of the flows of money to Russia. And we have no money. You know, there's no war. So this is really up to us. Now, of course, we can supply more weapons to Ukraine. We can do things like that. Mm-hmm. But really, I see this as a financial battle. Mm-hmm. And we have not been waging it with the determination and vigor that is necessary, because we can end this war in months.
Asked this week about the big military parade and President Xi's bilateral meetings with the leaders of so many countries currying favor with China, President Trump acknowledged it was an impressive parade, but he did seem to shrug off concerns, saying China still needs the U.S. more than any other countries. What does he mean by that?
Well, China right now is more export dependent than it has been in the communist period. And the U.S. accounts for something like 34-35% of global consumer spending. So China absolutely needs the United States. And its economy will fail if it doesn't have access to the U.S. market. So, yes, President Trump holds the high cards. China has some cards, too. So, for instance, rare earths and magnets, as we know about, pharmaceuticals. But the U.S. has far more. Ultimately, we're the bigger economy, and also we are a trade deficit country. Mm. And in trade wars, trade surplus countries are the ones that get the worst of it. And we should know that, because during the 1930s, during a trade war, we were the trade surplus country. And during the Great Depression, we were hurt more than any other country. If we were going to actually use and play the cards we have, I think China has to back down.
Mm. Gordon Chang, thank you so much for your expertise and insight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kat.
Congress is back to work on Capitol Hill after a month-long summer recess. Time is short to reach a budget agreement or risk the possibility of a government shutdown. Current funding runs out at the end of September, and lawmakers have to pass something to keep the government open. But weighty matters like the looming budget deadline took a backseat this week to the brewing Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking scandal. Survivors rallied on Capitol Hill this week to pressure lawmakers to release more information about the multi-year federal investigation into the late financier. Hundreds of women were trafficked and abused by Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell. They are demanding justice after all these years and are calling on the Trump administration to provide transparency and accountability for what they endured when they were teenagers. On the campaign trail, candidate Trump had signaled an extensive release of the Epstein files, but this summer the White House changed course, calling such a release a, quote, hostile act against the administration. Asked about the Epstein scandal on Wednesday, President Trump called it a Democrat hoax. But some vocal Republicans are pushing back.
This is my fifth year in Congress, and this is the largest press conference that I've seen since I've been here. And this is because this is an issue that matters so much to Americans. This is an issue that doesn't have political boundaries. It's an issue that Republicans and Democrats should never fight about.
Mr. President Donald J. Trump, I am a registered Republican, not that that matters because this is not political. However, I cordially invite you to the Capitol to meet me in person so you can understand this is not a hoax. We are real human beings. This is real trauma.
This is not a partisan issue. This is a crime, the crime of sex trafficking, and the criminals must be held accountable. Disbelieving survivors creates a culture of silence. There is strength in numbers, and our courage is contagious.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene called the Epstein scandal a boiling point in American history. The debate continues in Congress over what's known as a discharge petition. If enough lawmakers sign it, it could force a congressional vote compelling the Justice Department to release the entire Epstein file and expose the powerful and wealthy men, many believed to be billionaires, world leaders, and politicians, who were part of the Epstein sex trafficking ring. And more tense moments on Capitol Hill on Thursday during an appearance by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in front of the Senate Finance Committee. His testimony comes as he faces growing criticism and calls to resign from both within his department and from some lawmakers. Senators, including those who helped to confirm him, grilled RFK Jr. for more than 3 hours, particularly on his efforts to curb access to the COVID-19 vaccine and to slash mRNA vaccine development.
You don't know the answer of how many Americans died from COVID. This is the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Do you think the vaccine did anything to prevent additional deaths?
Again, I would like to see the data and talk about the data.
You have had this job for 8 months, and you don't know the data about whether the vaccine saved lives?
That's the problem.
Email from a physician friend of mine. Hey, Bill. I'm not even sure what I'm asking you, but we're all confused and concerned about who can get the COVID vaccine. I would say effectively we're denying people vaccine.
Senator Cantwell.
You're wrong.
Kennedy also faced questions over former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Susan Monares, who served in the role for less than a month. She claims that she was fired last week for refusing to, quote, compromise on science itself when it comes to vaccines, a claim he denied. And in another noteworthy moment from the hearing, when asked by Oklahoma Senator James Lankford on whether he's reviewed safety issues with the abortion drug mifepristone, Secretary Kennedy said he recently discovered former President Joe Biden, quote, twisted the data on mifepristone to bury safety concerns. He confirmed the FDA's review of abortion drugs is underway in a move applauded by pro-life leaders. Meanwhile, Florida's Surgeon General Dr. Joseph Ladapo announced on Wednesday the state will move to eliminate all vaccine mandates, including those for school children. Florida is the first state to plan to remove decades-long and constitutionally upheld requirements for vaccinations against measles, polio, and other infectious diseases. More and more people are skipping the shots. Last year, school year, kindergartners had a record high exemption rate of 3.6%. Ladapo argues vaccination should be an individual choice, but health experts worry the move will lead to more dangerous outbreaks.
You know, pretty much every state has them. It's wrong. It's immoral. They do not have the right to tell you what you put in your body.
Even something like measles, right, which for the vast majority of people will give rise to mild disease, 1 in 20 kids will be hospitalized with measles, right? one in 100 kids will have a neurological episode, might have seizures, right? And one in 1,000 kids might die, right? And so, you know, those are all serious and severe and scary outcomes for families and for parents, and vaccines absolutely prevent those.
Some mandates can be rolled back by Florida's health department, but others will require state legislation. All states allow medical exemptions for vaccines. Many also allow citizens to opt out for religious or personal reasons. On Thursday, a federal appeals court temporarily lifted an order that limited Trump's use of the National Guard in Los Angeles. This comes just days after a district judge ruled the operations unlawful. Trump activated thousands of members of California's National Guard in Los Angeles this summer as part of his crackdown on immigration. Only a few hundred remain. The federal judge ruled on Tuesday, while the troops could be used to defend federal property, they cannot perform arrests, searches, and crowd control. The appeals court lifted those restrictions in an effort to maintain the status quo until it rules on the merits of the case. Trump has also sent National Guard members into Washington, D.C., and is talking about doing the same in Chicago. Late this week, the District of Columbia filed its own lawsuit challenging the president, saying the use of the military for domestic law enforcement is illegal. Aid agencies are asking the international community for support after a devastating earthquake in Afghanistan left more than 2,200 people dead. The magnitude 6 quake struck the country's mountainous and remote east on Sunday night, a region that already struggles with a lack of resources. Afghanistan's international support dropped significantly after the Taliban took over in 2021. We'll take a break now and be right back.
I can take this place.
The director of a film about the life of Saint Maximilian Kolbe and his imprisonment in a Nazi concentration camp joins us to discuss next week's U.S. premiere of this powerful new movie.
We end our program with a special look at an upcoming film about one of the most well-known modern saints, priest and martyr, Maximilian Kolbe. But this movie begins where other retellings usually end. The Nazis arrested the Polish Franciscan in 1941, sending him to the notorious concentration camp at Auschwitz. Months after his arrival, 10 men were sent to starvation chamber. And when one of the prisoners begged to be spared for the sake of his family, Kolbe courageously took his place. Triumph of the Heart begins with that sacrifice and shows how Kolbe's faith and compassion led him and his fellow prisoners to encounter hope and companionship in the face of unimaginable suffering. Anthony D'Ambrosio, the writer and director of The Triumph of the Heart, felt inspired to make this film after Kolbe guided him through his own suffering. He recently sat down with me to share his story and how he hopes Kolbe's final days can help others find hope. I read that you were inspired to write this at a really dark and difficult time in your life. How did St. Maximilian Kolbe break through to you? And do you mind sharing more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am somebody that struggled with a chronic illness. And that illness materialized sort of at the point in most people's lives when they're about to sort of enter into kind of the zenith of health and to sort of move forward into their vocation. And for me, I moved from that place of hopefulness and sort of vivaciousness into being struck down and really having kind of the dreams of who I was going to be in my life really torn away from me. And in the midst of that time, I really was grieving and I lost my faith. But it was kind of a discovery of Maximilian Kolbe and certain details of his story, specifically the detail that I had known that he had saved the life of another man, that he had volunteered to go into the starvation bunker, but I didn't realize that he ended up leading all of these other men around him in songs and in prayers, and ultimately that he wasn't executed alone, but that he was executed with and beside 4 other men who also stayed alive with him for 14 days without food or water. And it felt to me like absolutely a miracle that Kolbe could bring people from where perhaps I was to a place of being able to sing songs and praise God even in the midst of that grief and that darkness. And if he could do that, then perhaps he could help me to learn how to suffer well. And I think that Colby's story about a man who is willing to not just trade his life with another man to sort of save him, but also to descend into the suffering of these other men, to pastor them, to bring them to the Lord, to give meaning to their suffering and bring a balm of love to their hearts. That is a story of heroism and of credibility that shows a witness of faith that I think all of us need in our lives to give us hope and also to give us somebody to follow.
Triumph of the Heart will premiere in more than 400 theaters nationwide next week on September 12th. Learn more about this film and how to find a screening near you at triumphoftheheart.com. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope you'll join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.